Yeah, absolutely. And if I went back and listened to, I went back and listened to three episodes in preparation for this, but they were recent ones. If I went back and listened to the very first episodes you did, you were almost certainly not as good an interviewer back then as you are now. What has allowed you to be a better interviewer is just seeing those patterns and doing it over and over again. What has allowed you to do it over and over again is deciding to be a podcast host. That is a positioning decision you made that then landed you in front of many repeated patterns, and then you started to notice those patterns and articulate them, even if you've never written them down. You're a much, so it's just, it illustrates exactly. And every expert is an expert because of pattern matching. And the only way you put yourself in the right place to be noticing similar patterns is to make a really smart positioning decision. So that's how it all connects in my mind.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. David, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
I am very glad to be here. I've been looking forward to this quite some time. I show up as a guest on a whole bunch of podcasts, and is it okay to say I'm not excited about all of them, but this one I'm very excited about.
Well, thank you for those kind words. We hope we'll live up to your expectations. So, you know, I came across your work because somebody on your team wrote in, they told me a little bit about your book. And as I was saying just before we hit record here, it was not just the book, but when I read your bio and your background, I thought, oh yeah, there is definitely a really interesting story here. But before we get into all of that, I would like to start by asking you, what did your parents do for a living? And what impact did that end up having on the choices that you made with them?
What did they do for a living? Okay, so what I tell people they did is that they were medical missionaries, and they were. So they were missionaries in this Protestant mission, and dad did dental work, mom did nursing work, and then together they did literacy work. That's not the whole story. The whole story is that beyond that, they also did church planning, but I'm not all that proud of that part of their lives, so I don't usually mention that. But now, of course, I've just done it to the world, right? Yeah, so that we did that in the highlands of Guatemala, and we lived there during the height of the Civil War. So I was there. I was born in the U.S. I'm a U.S. citizen, but left when I was, you know, too young to remember anything, and I was 4, and didn't come back to live in the U.S. until I was 18. And I was basically just dragged around based on what my parents were doing. We spent a year in Costa Rica first, learning Spanish. They were in Spanish school for a year. You know, with kids, you can just drop them in anywhere and they learn a language. So I still vividly remember getting dropped into a Spanish kindergarten and with no trauma whatsoever. So we were there for a year, and then we went to Guatemala and lived in this incredibly remote, you know, no electricity, no running water, no roads, no stores, no gas stations. And that's where I lived for 13 years till I came to the U.S. and thoroughly embarrassed myself trying to fit into the culture, which I was not used to at the time.
Wow. Okay. So many questions already. You mentioned they were medical missionaries and you brought up church. And I wonder, one, did you grow up with a particular set of religious or spiritual beliefs? And two, how have those evolved over the course of your life?
Yes, I did grow up with them, but it was really a borrowed set of beliefs. I didn't know that at the time, but I was following in their footsteps and I was a dutiful son. So it was Protestant, Christian upbringing. I'm not that interested in organized religion at the moment. There's so many things that are disgusting about it to me, but I haven't chucked the whole thing. I find that I'm definitely a person of faith. So I believe there's a God. I believe it matters how we live. Beyond that, it gets pretty murky for me. So there was, you know, it was a borrowed faith, and then I just ran from it. Overdid it, running away from it. And then I've come back to a very comfortable place where I consider myself a person of faith, but not a person of religion, so to speak. I don't know if that makes sense to people. Some people probably understand that.
Yeah, I think that in my mind, I think when you try to force anything on anybody, they're going to resist it. And usually when you let, you know, go of trying to force them on it, they tend to come back to it on their own. And I wonder, do you think that that was the case with you as well?
I think it was, although I honestly, I felt really lied to for so many years. And that's really what got me to pursue, you know, higher ed in that space, learning original languages, Hebrew, Aramaic, Syriac, Greek. Because I would hear these preachers talk and they would kind of, you know, step out of normal English and say, now the original text says such and such. And I was thinking, oh, you know, wow, that's pretty amazing. But of course, at that point, when they started saying that, I lost all ability to verify it because I just didn't know any of those original languages. That's what got me into wanting to learn them. And so I felt really cheated, honestly, because I felt like the rest of the world wasn't given a chance to, it was a very much us versus them. I'm grateful for, you know what? Missionaries are really entrepreneurs who can't work for anybody else. I've figured that out over time. And I really admire a lot of the values that my parents instilled in me, but I'm just not on that boat, so to speak now. But yeah, interesting.
So you mentioned that you spent 13 years in a place with what sounds like no technology whatsoever, almost Amish sounding from the way that you described it. And I wonder, what did you bring back from that you apply to your life today in a world in which we're completely inundated with technology to the point where people probably in places like that even have access to cell phones?
They do, because I go back and I visit once or twice a year. And the little village, it was called San Miguel Acatan. It was above a place called Huehuetenango in Guatemala. And I go back and visit, and virtually it's unchanged, except now there's a cell tower in the middle of the village, and all these Mayan Indian folks are running around with cell phones to their ears. But so they skipped the whole phone/wired generation. You know, the only technology we had was ham radio, so we would conduct one-way conversations back and forth to places around the world. You know, what I came back to the U.S. with is partly, and this is a little bit hard to describe, but a very, I think it's a world-centric versus a country-centric view. But the main thing beyond that, and that's pretty obvious, I guess, but the main thing beyond that is just recognizing that so many of the things that we think are so central to our lives are just constructs of our particular time in history. And I think we could be so much more flexible than we are. For instance, I was having breakfast with a neighbor this morning at the, we call it the awful house around here. It's a Waffle House, but we're having breakfast there and we were talking. They took their kids out of school. They go to public school, three young kids. They took them out for 6 months and toured the country. And we were talking about how much more beneficial that was to those kids than the normal school. And I think that, you know, we work so hard to have the perfect setup for our kids, the exact right education, the right job opportunities and everything, without realizing that this stuff kind of takes care of itself. And we get lost in our bubbles and feel like, okay, our kids have to have their own car, they have to have their own phone, they have to go to these schools, they have to start school when they're four, they have to be in the right ones. It's like, really? Is life really that fragile? Like, in where I grew up, you know, my parents weren't all that interested in teaching me. They were busy doing other things. So they ordered this correspondence course and then they just dropped it on me and said, all right, go to town. And so I taught myself all those years in school and it was fine. I don't know that I missed anything. And it makes me wonder sometimes how we could be so much more flexible and so much more interesting in our lives if we didn't accept as normal everything that's thrown at us. We don't have to go to school at three. We don't have to go to high school. We don't have to go to college. We don't have to follow these career paths. We don't have to get married at this time. But everybody around us is doing it, and we don't understand that it could be different. I'm just rambling now.
No, this is fantastic. I think it makes a perfect setup to my next question. you seem to have been in an environment in which you were pretty much immune to the social programming that most of us experience through media, culture, parents, peer society. I wonder, how do we overcome that if we weren't in a situation where we weren't exposed to a significant amount of social programming?
Yeah. My friends would say, David, it's too bad you didn't have more social programming, probably, because I'm a little bit of a loner, and acceptance of me is not as important as I think it probably normally would, just because I wasn't around people like me for so many years. I wish I had the answer to that. We have grown children who are both married, both have kids. We took a quite different approach in raising them. We didn't feel like we were doing it just to be different. We just felt like, okay, let's step back here and let's figure out what's really essential and what isn't. Okay, so what's really essential with a child would be to read to them a lot. The other is to play with them, to spend time with them and not have babysitters all the time. The other is, get them, buy things for them that will enhance their creativity. So I remember buying a really expensive video camera for Nathan when he was, I think it was 7. And we didn't have much money at the time. We paid over $1,000 for it. And I remember our friends saying, "What in the world? That's totally wasted. He'll break that within a couple of weeks." He didn't. He was pretty careful with it. But the stuff he did with that was so amazing. We just said, okay, no TV until I think it was 14. We didn't have one for ourselves either. It's not like there's anything magic there. Then I remember one day them saying to me, "Okay, Dad, when can we start dating?" And Julie and I, my wife, looked at each other and we kind of talked about it and came back to them and said, "How about when you're 17? And, they're freaking out. It's like, "What, 17? Like, that's crazy." And they said, "So what's the, what's magic about 17? I said, "Nothing. I just made a decision. I don't know that it matters all that much." Then, of course, the younger one comes to me and quietly by himself. And he says, "Dad, I understand for Jonathan, but I'm not going to be as good at this as he is. I think I should be able to start earlier, but just not being afraid to be different and looking at your world and saying, okay, how can we raise them? And we're going to accept a lot of the convention that the world sends our way, but let's think about it as an outsider. Why do we have to do all of this stuff?" And I just feel like we're a little afraid to be different sometimes. We don't want to be different just to be different, but we should be filtering these decisions that we're making if we're really trying to encourage our kids to be creative.
Wow. So given the way that you were educated and the way that you were brought up, if somebody asked you to come into our school system and redesign the curriculum and the way students that are taught today, how would you do it based on where the world is headed?
Yeah. When our kids were in elementary school, I made it a point to teach, guest teach every semester because I wanted to be connected to my kids' friends. And I also wanted their teachers to know me. I felt like they might treat my kids a little bit more respectfully if they knew me, if they had an image of my face in there. So I would go in and it was really, I loved it. I mean, one year I set up a whole photography lab and taught them how to take pictures. And that was so much fun. What I would do differently is I would not start school so early. Obviously, I'm never going to get elected to any school board after you hear this, right? I'm also not going to expect the school system to do what I think parents should be doing. I think it's ridiculous. I would never want to be a teacher full-time because these teachers are having to be parents without the authority to be parents. I would not set up babysitting. To me, a lot of education, elementary ed, seems to me it enables the parents to not have to worry about what to do with the kids until they get home. And I don't think that's the role of school. I would also spend a lot more time playing, supervised playing. I would spend a lot more time reading. I would spend less time on math. Oh, goodness. Do you think people are still listening to this episode the way I'm going on here?
Yeah, I think they are.
I just think we've gotten it so wrong. You know, I don't know where, and look at the, and look at the result of our schooling. It doesn't seem to be all that effective. It seems we're pouring so much money and it's becoming a very expensive, socially conscious babysitting service. And I wish somebody would have the courage to rethink the whole thing, but it just seems like it's almost the third rail. We can't touch that education thing, really.
Mm, wow. Well, speaking of education, so you came back from this time in Guatemala. One, did you experience some level of reverse culture shock, and what was adapting to the American culture like after spending so much time there? And from having read your bio, what I've gathered is that your path, like most people that I talk to, is anything but linear. So can you walk us through how you get from Guatemala to being the guy who writes a book on the business of expertise?
Yeah. So that's the fifth book. Not all of them have been good. The first one was so much of a, pretty much a disaster. It was a ghost-written book on the genetic underpinnings of seed corn. Thank goodness nobody ever read that, I don't think. The culture shock was pretty significant. My first memory of what was happening in the U.S. was listening to the Nixon impeachment trial or hearings on Armed Forces Radio over shortwave, and I was just fascinated by this. I didn't know what was going on or anything. It just felt like such a different world to me, because for news, we usually listen to the BBC. So I came back to the U.S., and the first time I really lived here for a while was when I was 18. And I was visiting on that first trip, I was visiting a friend of my parents in Little Rock, Arkansas. And if I remember the dates right, the day we got there, this guy named Elvis died. And I had no idea who he was, but we stayed up all night watching movies of Elvis, the actor. And I kept thinking to myself, what in the world are we doing? This guy is a terrible actor. I don't understand why everybody is so broken up about his death. Then I discovered the next morning that he was a musician who also was an actor. That was the first time I'd heard of him. So, and then, you know, then the next afternoon I'm walking down the street and this guy comes up to me, and I was walking on the street and he came over to me walking on the lawn, and he said, "Hey, do you want to buy some grass?" And he had some what looked like grass in a little plastic bag. And I thought, why would I buy grass? I mean, I could just reach down here and grab it. I just, you know, I had no idea what that was. I remember back then you flew from Latin America into New Orleans instead of Dallas or Miami like you do now. And flew in there, and I'm by myself in the men's restroom. And I finish urinating, and I walk over to wash my hands, and I'm just really impressed with this sink. It's this huge stainless steel wide sink with the water running all the time, and I come up and I put my hands in it. I don't even have to turn the faucet on. Very impressed with this. Like, what an innovation in the U.S. that they've come up with this sink idea. And then other men come in and start peeing next to me as I'm washing my hands in what turns out to be a urinal. I thought it was a sink. So it's like this stuff just happens over and over and over again. And it's funny now, but at the time it was, yeah, kind of embarrassing. But so many things, I wish I'd kept a journal back then, because so many things struck me as odd because I just hadn't seen them. And then, of course, where I was really at a major disadvantage was in playing any kind of game like Trivial Pursuit, where you had to understand and remember elements of the culture, and all of that escaped me. I was the worst partner. Everybody would draw straws and hope they didn't get me as their partner in Trivial Pursuit, because I just simply didn't know any of those things. But it also gave me a slightly different perspective. I think the way I look at things is almost always to turn them upside down and say, okay, what are the assumptions that I'm bringing to the solution as I try to solve this problem? And many times those assumptions that I'm making and that your listeners are making, you know, and the people around us are making are just crazy assumptions that don't really necessarily make sense. But then, so you come up with a slightly different perspective and you verbalize it, and everybody around you is looking at you like you're somebody from a foreign planet or something, because the idea seems so strange. And then after they think about it a little bit more, they realize, oh, that's unconventional, but that's a really interesting idea. So, you know, back to your question, I it was really traumatic that coming back here at 18 was much more difficult than moving down there when I was 4. I just accepted everything at that point, and I just had no idea how the U.S. worked, really. I'm there's still some things that confuse me, but I'm caught on to a lot of it anyway.
So how do you get from there to, you know, writing this book? I know you've done a bunch of other really interesting things in your career. I wonder, what has the trajectory been like?
Yeah. So, yeah, sorry, I should have answered that question better. I was in grad school and I was headed for the same sort of field my parents were. And halfway through, I realized, oh my goodness, this is not for me. Then I thought, okay, I'll teach ancient languages, those dead languages in graduate school in some place in the world. And about halfway through that program, this was a 5 years full-time in grad school, halfway through that program, I realized that the whole higher ed environment was pretty political. I decided that, okay, this isn't really for me. But I was halfway through it. We had kids. I was working full-time. Thought, I'll just finish this. Lying on the couch one day, reading the newspaper, and it just struck me how poorly the job other firms were doing at marketing. I thought, okay, I kind of understand the human psyche. Maybe I can run a marketing firm. So I started one, accidental entrepreneur, really. But it grew into a 16-person firm. Did that for 6 years. Part of my part of how I learned how to do things was a subscription that I had. I'm just fast forwarding real quickly here, but it was a subscription to a publication. You got to call the editor and ask him questions as a part of the subscription. It didn't cost any more money. And so we developed this rapport. And one day I said to him, Cam, why don't you do consulting to these people instead of just a publication? He wasn't interested for his own reasons, but he said, why don't you do it? Before I could answer, he said, I'll put an ad in the publication and you just give me 10% of whatever you make. And I thought, well, maybe. I can't imagine people calling, but why not? What do I have to lose? People started calling immediately. And that was the launch of what's now called Recourses. I've been doing this for 24 years, where I work with entrepreneurial experts. And so I was drinking from a water hose in those first few days. But the thing that changed my life entirely from a business perspective is that I was spending a lot of money trying to get clients, especially in those early days. And I thought, all right, I've got to figure out a way to get clients without spending all this money. And I decided to do, nowadays it's called content marketing. At the time, it wasn't really a thing. Decided to develop an email list on a website. If I write a lot of content, then people will come and then I don't have to pay. And then when I need some work, I'll just ask them if they need some help. So that was the beginning of 2.5 decades of writing as good an insight as I could muster. And I loved writing. I discovered that that's, for me, it's almost like an addiction. If I'm not writing enough, I start to shake. I start to get grumpy. I start to feel unsettled. I don't know where I fit in the world. And I decided that I don't know exactly where this will head, but writing needs to be a part of who I am. For me, it's not coming up with things that are worth talking about and then articulating them. For me, the clarity comes in the articulation. And so if I'm not writing, I'm not getting clear on things. And so it naturally evolved into a ghostwriting the first book, the really nasty book, and then writing 4 other books, including this most recent one on expertise. And this one has been very different than the others because it's been a very passionate manifesto for me. It wasn't like the earlier ones, which were very similar to kind of a, I don't know, an encyclopedia article. They were like reference volumes. This one comes from inside me. I feel so strongly that people who deserve it should be experts, should know how to act as experts, should know how to position themselves, how to charge. And so this was my attempt to help the world. I'm pleased that it's been received exceedingly well, but I would have written it even if it hadn't, just honestly.
Yeah. Okay. So we're going to get into the entire idea of expertise, how we become experts, how we charge for our expertise and all of that. But there are two other threads here that I didn't want to let go before we get into all of that. The fact that you were both an airline and helicopter pilot. Where do those two things fit into all of this?
Well, they kind of fit because I get bored easily. So, you know, growing up in that country, aviation is kind of how you get from one place to the other sometimes. So I developed this love of flying just as an observer and a passenger. And on my 30th birthday, I remember driving past this airport to get to my office. I had to pass this airport every day going to and from work. And I just thought, why don't I just do this? This just seems interesting. And I was working for a company at the time that needed a corporate pilot. Of course, usually when you need a corporate pilot, you want somebody who has experience doing it. But they were game in they were game and paying for all of it for me, not just getting the private license for fixed wing is what it's called for airplane, and then rotorcraft is what it's called for helicopter. They were game to pay for it, but then pay for all the other ratings that I got, including instrument rating and so on. And then I used that for that company. And then I used it for myself, had a plane and flew myself all over the country for consulting engagements, speaking engagements. And then on my 40th birthday, I thought, okay, this fixed wing stuff is boring me. You're only necessary to take off and land or if something goes bad. Otherwise, you're just setting the autopilot and you're just working away. So I thought I would stretch myself and do the helicopter thing. And I didn't think it would be that big an issue. It turned out to be much harder than I thought. It was really a humbling experience. But actually, I love both. I don't know what it is. It's something about getting above all of the issues that are crowding into your life and getting a slightly bigger perspective. You look down on earth, on the issues that you're struggling with, and you see it in a slightly different light. It seems smaller to you. You feel like you're looking down on yourself, like you're having an out-of-body experience. And even in bad weather, especially if it's overcast, you climb through those clouds and you bust out, and it's always sunny above those clouds. There's just, it's really influenced my life. When I think about, we could go on and on for hours just talking about all of the parallels between flying and business and so on. It's you can tell as I talk about it, it's a real deep love of mine.
Hey, it's Srini. Quick exercise for you. How many times do you check your phone on an average workday? 1, 5, a few times an hour? Now take that number and multiply it by 23. That's how many minutes of real concentration you actually lose when you check your phone. It takes an average of 23 minutes to return to the original task after an interruption, according to Gloria Mark, who studies digital distraction at the University of California, Irvine. And if you work in a typical office space, digital distractions are just half the picture. People popping in for quick questions, meetings, and the smell of someone's lunch wafting out of the break room are all regular occurrences. So what does this mean for you? Whether you're an ambitious creative, a student, or in the workforce, all it takes is one or two distractions an hour, and your whole day can be robbed of any significant productive work. Most people recognize this as a problem in their lives, but think fixing it is easier said than done. But I haven't found that to be the case. And that's why I created Distraction Mastery, my time management course designed for busy people. You don't have to cut yourself off from the world or give up Instagram and Netflix. You don't need to be more disciplined or use a lot of willpower. If this has been a problem for you, I'd love to show you how to eliminate your time robbing distractions, master your attention, and get in the zone on command without giving up Netflix or social media. Just check out unmistakablecreative.com/distractionmastery. And for Unmistakable Creative listeners, use the code 80, all capitalized E-I-G-H-T-Y, to get the course for 80% off.
What did you learn about habits, systems, and decision-making from those two experiences that you've applied to your life going forward?
That's like a diving board into the whole flying thing, because look at how, I don't know what the numbers are, but you know, there's got to be tens of thousands of flights every day and how safe it is. To me, that demonstrates the value of repeatable training and processes. Like, wow, that is amazing to think about how few accidents there are given all the variables out there. The other thing, and this one, so that one's been with me a long time. This one is something I've only been thinking about the last week, but it's seared in my conscience. I don't know exactly what I'm going to do with this, but the best model I know of for management and teaching is the flight instructor, because the flight instructor has to snatch the controls back right before both of you die. If he grabs them too early, you don't really learn. And he is sitting over there. He has a copy of the controls. He can grab them at any point. I don't know why I'm saying he. All of my instructors were females, actually. She can grab the controls at any point, but she has to talk me through things, and she can't. If she keeps stepping in, I will never learn. And that's such a great metaphor for how we teach people to be adults, how we teach them to be leaders and managers, letting them make mistakes, and grabbing the controls only in an absolute emergency. I don't know that we're really good. I think we grab the controls too quickly in some cases.
Wow. Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears a little bit and start getting into this entire idea of the business of expertise, because I think that what struck me most about the way that you laid this out was you gave people a framework that could be applied to virtually any situation. One, where did this framework come from? And then let's get into the details. And I think where I want to start is with this. You said that pattern matching is the basis of all intelligence. The concept of pattern matching has particular relevance to the motion of expertise and how we develop expertise. And that struck me in particular because of the fact that I've talked to more than 700 people. And I think that inevitably what starts to happen is you begin to notice patterns.
Mm, right. You, as the podcast host, notice patterns.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And if I went back and listened to, three episodes in preparation for this, but they were recent ones. If I went back and listened to the very first episodes you did, you were almost certainly not as good an interviewer back then as you are now. What has allowed you to be a better interviewer is just seeing those patterns and doing it over and over again. What has allowed you to do it over and over again is deciding to be a podcast host. That is a positioning decision you made that then landed you in front of many repeated patterns, and then you started to notice those patterns and articulate them, even if you've never written them down. It illustrates exactly. And every expert is an expert because of pattern matching. And the only way you put yourself in the right place to be noticing similar patterns is to make a really smart positioning decision. So that's how it all connects in my mind.
Yeah. So we'll get into positioning. So I happen to be the beneficiary of the fact that I have the podcast and an opportunity to notice patterns, and that's taken the better part of 700 interviews in 10 years. Is the ability to develop your capacity for pattern matching something that simply just takes time because you need so much data in order to develop it?
I don't know how much time you need. Really intelligent people can notice some provisional patterns, after two or three opportunities. And really smart people who contribute to their world in that way, I think they are so naturally curious that they notice things that most of the rest of the world doesn't. But, and I mean even silly things. So they check into a hotel, and if you stop them right after they got in their room, they set their suitcase down, and you stop them at that moment and said, "All right, tell me all the little things you noticed when you came in here." And these wouldn't have been relevant to you unless you had checked into 500 other hotels. They would probably be able to list 30 or 40 things immediately off the top of their head. That the way they're wired is to observe things. They just notice things that other people don't. And that's what allows them to process. And it's just such an interesting world. You know, what really set me on this path was watching that movie, A Beautiful Mind. You remember when John Nash is in that room and the code is rolling down the walls, and he notices patterns in the enemy code that nobody else does. That's what really prompted this whole book idea, is that he saw the patterns when other people didn't. And there was something, in his case, it wasn't so much, you know, he'd seen so many lines of code roll down the walls. It was that he was super intelligent and he could pick out those patterns and other people couldn't.
Yeah. So, you know, we look at pattern matching as the basis of intelligence and expertise. What if somebody feels like they're not an expert in anything or they don't have any expertise? One, how do they discover what their expertise is? And then two, how do you take that and position that in a way that leads to premium pricing, which I know is something you talk about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of people who feel like they don't have expertise, in my experience, really do have expertise, but they're so used to seeing it in themselves that it doesn't strike them as odd. And then that first stage is they don't feel like they're experts. An outsider that might be in a better position to make that judgment call does see that they're an expert. And then that second stage is when the marketplace begins to see that they have expertise and wants and create some sort of demand. When the marketplace regularly wants to pay you for your thinking, that's when I think the real expertise begins, in a way that confirms how you should be feeling. But a lot of people are actually quite, they're full of a lot more expertise than they think, earlier than they think. And these are the kind of people that they just take for granted everything they learn. But if you have an expert interviewer, like, I don't mean a formal one, but you're sitting next to somebody in a plane and you have a few minutes to talk, and you ask what they're doing, just what they've done for a living, just politely, and they tell you, and then you start and you say, okay, I know a little bit about that and I am not stupid. Then you start asking them questions and you have 10 or 15 aha moments, things that you didn't even realize. And up until this point, that person that you're talking to didn't really think of themselves as an expert, but the right person asking the right questions helps them put their expertise into context. And so I find it's odd to me, but some people who call themselves experts, I'm not that impressed with, and other people who don't call themselves experts, I love talking to people. I love pulling that out, whatever their expertise is. So it's not easy to know really for yourself how much of an expert you are. I think the only way you know for sure is if clients are willing to pay you regularly for your thinking. Now, I'm talking about expertise from a thought leadership standpoint, not so much expertise like in a craft standpoint. So you're really you're amazing at building guitars. Mm-hmm. That's expertise, but that's not the kind of expertise I'm talking about.
Yeah. So one other thing that you said, and I think this is particularly relevant to the world we live in, you said a hobby costs you money, and many of you who are peddling expertise are really engaging in a hobby. You aren't taking it seriously, aren't making the tough positioning business decisions, aren't being all that courageous, and aren't applying the daily discipline to execute your plan. That struck me in particular because of the fact that we live in this world of everybody being a media company or everybody being a content creator with unlimited access to resources and distribution channels virtually for free. And it can make us feel like we're engaging in something that is a business when in reality it is a hobby. So how do you distinguish between those two things? And why is this so common?
It is so common, and it's also so tough because the signal to noise ratio out there is just astronomical. The delta between those two can just keep you awake at night when you think about how in the world am I going to stand out in this world? Thinking about how the world has been Googleized as well can be so deflating. You know, 15, 20 years ago, you were an expert, but you were an expert largely because people only had access to a certain number of experts in your area of expertise within that certain geography around them. So there was limited competition, also limited opportunity. Google came along and Googleized our world. And when that happened, consumers' expectations changed drastically almost overnight. Now we have this expectation that on almost any subject, well, we could just eliminate the word almost, on any subject, within seconds, we can find exactly what we need and it will be free. I was having to, you know, we bought a 61-acre piece of property recently, and there's a third of a mile gravel road that desperately needs to be rebuilt. And I get the equipment, that's the easy part. And I'm thinking, okay, how am I going to do this without killing myself? And you know, rolling a piece of equipment over on myself. And I'm lying in bed at night thinking about that. I say, oh, I know. I just go to YouTube. There'll be a bunch of fools that have more time on their hands than they need, and they will have put together all kinds of videos telling me exactly how to do this, and I'll find it instantly, and the information will be free. Well, that's exciting if you need to build a road, but if you're trying to be an expert, how in the world are you going to make a really good living when all of this other information is out there, right? It just demonstrates how important it is to be narrow, 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 and dig really, really deep. But that's not enough. You also have to have a point of view, a clear point of view that will resonate with your audience, with some of your audience. The folks that it doesn't resonate with, they are going to want to dismiss you and move on. We can't be afraid to have a watershed attraction point in our point of view. So it's not just deep knowledge, but also this perspective or this point of view that at the end of it, anybody listening or reading or whatever is going to say, oh, I want more of that. Or they're going to say, I want less of that. The thing that terrifies me in today's world is to be ignorable, is to be not remembered. And we don't want to be controversial just to be remembered, but we have to have a clear point of view. People, in all of this information that we have out there, people are more confused than ever. The information is not the solution to the world's problems. Over and over again, we've seen that that's the case. In all of this noise, people want clearer perspectives, simpler perspectives. They want stuff that resonates. And as an expert, your job is to bring that pattern matching and intelligence and courage to the situation and objectivity as an outsider. That's the essence of what consulting or advising means or being an expert. I know I'm kind of yelling here, but I just feel really passionate about it. The world doesn't need an expertise that's less than that. They need objectivity and courage and a clear point of view. And that's what this book is about, is how to develop it. I mean, it's just a little handbook. So I don't know how far can we get with a little handbook, but I want to set people off on the right path where it's almost like a license to learn. Let's quit making shit up. Let's really know what we're talking about and giving people something for their money. It's not that hard. The incompetence of the world around us should be an everlasting source of hope. It's not that difficult to be helpful to people. And, you know, paying attention to our craft can, it's not as hard as it seems. It takes discipline, it takes courage, but the world is hungry for experts. And it's such a great way to make a living. I'm excited about it still.
Yeah. That for me raises a question of what happens when we start to automate a lot of jobs. You've talked about the role that having access to information has played. So I wonder from your perspective, the only reason it's fresh on my mind is I was watching this documentary last night and they were showing all the things that robotics and AI were doing. And I was thinking to myself, wow, robots are making lattes. And yeah, that probably would be a lot more efficient than the guy at my Starbucks who makes a latte.
Right. And he wouldn't insist on talking to you if you're tired in the morning and haven't had your coffee yet. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, people who make lattes ought to be terrified, you know, but there's always going to be this niche for people who don't want to buy a latte from a machine, and they'll pay even more for it. And 95% of the world won't care, and they'll be glad to buy a latte for less money made by a computer. I know almost everybody around me is terrified about the influence of AI on the job market. I'm not. I just don't think it's going to be an issue. I think this will settle out, partly because in spite of all of the billions of dollars and the really smart people doing this, when I call up UPS to track a package, they still don't get it right. We are decades away from this ever being so good that it doesn't frustrate people. And I know that there will be segments of our world that will be totally dominated by AI. And if I were in one of those segments, I would be justifiably terrified. But As it is, I think we still have decades left and we'll figure it out. We're still the ones programming this stuff, so I'm not too worried about it. It makes for great movie fodder, but in real life, I don't think it's something we need to worry about, honestly.
Yeah. Well, so you talk about this idea of the why for your entrepreneurial expertise, which you basically divide into values, purpose, mission, and vision. And I wonder how you, one, figure out those four things and then align them so that you can tie it together, not just for impact, but for wealth as well. In other words, I guess, how do you tie all of this together and get paid for your expertise?
Yeah, because it is important. Absent that, we as humans are probably going to go down the money path or control path, which isn't good for anybody long term. So I'm trying to avoid that. On the other side of the road, I'm trying to avoid somebody that just simply wants to do good, but doesn't care enough about making a living. And while that sounds really noble, it's not sustainable. You can't send your kids to college on that. Plus, you'll get tired of it. Money will keep you interested in running a business that's smartly run. But beyond that, the world doesn't want to listen to experts that are cheap. It's just, even if you don't need the money, you need to be charging a lot of money because nobody's going to listen to you unless you do. So it's a matter of combining two things primarily, and then some people need to add a third one. I'm not one of those, but some people do. The two things that to me seem non-negotiable in expertise giving is that you need to really be moving the needle on behalf of right fit clients. Now, if it's not a right fit client, then don't worry about it. They weren't a fit for you. And if you didn't have any impact, that shouldn't keep you up at night. The other is that you should be making a lot of money for all the reasons that I mentioned, those two things. I trust you folks, your listeners, I trust you with the money more than I would any governed entity or any organization. I want people to make decisions with a lot of money. So I want people to have money and not organizations, not the government. So those are the two non-negotiables. Now, some people want to add a third as they think about all of this mission, values, you know, vision and stuff. That third one is they want to make sure that they really enjoy their work. I'm not an advocate of not enjoying your work, but I don't think it should be essential. If you do enjoy your work, then I think you should be very grateful for that and love it even more. But I think it's okay to require that you do a lot of things that you simply don't enjoy. If they come with being an expert, then you should do them. If it means you don't enjoy research, but if you need to be a smart expert, based on research, then you better do research even if you don't enjoy it, and so on. So all of these things, it's really to try and keep us out of both ditches. People that mean well and never make money and don't have much impact, and then people who are driven by money and control, and I'm trying to keep things in the middle. It's very aspirational, though. I'm not an official B Corp, but I was the first service firm in Tennessee to file for a new entity that the legislature created that says that I need to have a particular purpose and I need to report on it every year. And I really believe in that. I have a mission. At the end of this thing, I want to have made money. I want to have made an impact. I want to have made a huge impact, even in the people that never hired me. That's partly why I keep writing as well, because I have an opportunity to reach a larger audience of people who would never work with me if they're in their right minds, right? So yeah, it all fits together.
So I guess that leads me to the question I think that I've asked probably more than a handful of guests at this point. Why do we see such a variation in results, particularly when it comes to this area of your life? Like, why do you have the 1% and the 99%? I mean, you in particular have a unique view into this, given what you've just said.
Yeah. And this comes up when a prospective client contacts me and we're on the phone, and usually towards the end, they don't usually lead with this question, but they'll say, well, how impactful is your work? And, you know, I'll pause, not because I need to, but because I want them to think I'm reflecting, even though I know what the answer is. And I'll say, well, it's not that great, just honestly. It's probably 30 to 40%. And I'm okay with that. It seems like a low number, but let me ask you, how how many of your clients take your advice? You know, probably not that many either. We're at certain points. How many times has somebody that loves you and knows you really well, and there's something that they think you ought to do different in your life, and you have resisted that advice over and over again, and they have come right out and told you something, or they've intimated it, hinted at it 20 times, and at some point they're going to quit. Maybe at some point you'll take the advice, only because at that number 22 instance, you were ready to hear it. We all orbit closer and closer to the truth, and we're only really ready for it at certain points, and it's really hard to predict that. What's really interesting about your question is to think about democracy, right? Because democracy is based on this assumption that most of the people are right. And I don't believe that. I think democracy is a fantastic system until 50 years into it, when we start making self-serving voting decisions, avoiding some of the tougher calls that we should be making. So it's a fascinating topic to think about.
Wow. Well, this has been really, really mind-blowing. I feel like I could talk to you for another 2 hours and we'd barely scratch the surface.
Oh, it's been really fun. I'm sorry if I've droned on about some things. You kind of asked some very pointed questions that got me all riled up to think about. I hope it's been useful to your audience. Yeah. I really, really, really enjoy the opportunity just to chat with you. It's been a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Well, I have one final question for you, which I know you've heard me ask, and it's how we finish all of our interviews with Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I probably, I keep going back to that word, unignorable. And I think it's somebody that has the courage to have a point of view that they can support. And I love talking with people that have a deeply held perspective, even if I don't agree with it. And so I want to be touched by people. I want to be in the orbit of people who have thought carefully enough about something to have a point of view and can explain that to me, even if I disagree with it. I feel like that's where I'm going to learn. That's what makes creatives most unmistakable in my mind.
Well, I think that makes a perfect and fitting end to our conversation. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything that you're up to?
Probably the most recent book is at expertise.is, and then my consulting work is davidcbaker.com.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.